You know, I don't care if it's summer or winter. It's out here on the streets, it's not fun.
Homeless campers in Anchorage prepare to move back to the Sullivan Arena. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, September 30th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, storm damage in Newtok increases pressure for residents to relocate.
The island is the only safe place for our next generation to survive.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
More than 30 people marched in protest in Anchorage Thursday night, frustrated that Anchorage police officers still do not have body-worn cameras, now a year and a half after voters approved them. Celeste Hodge Groudon, president of the Alaska Black Caucus, led the rally, starting in front of the Anchorage Police Department's downtown headquarters. Her organization successfully advocated for the $1.8 million purchase of body cameras, which Anchorage voters approved in March 2021.
And to see that we are no further along is, I don't even want to say the word because, you know, I'm a Christian. So what I will say that it is quite disturbing.
Anchorage Police, the city, and the police officers' union have been negotiating the body-worn camera policy for months with no implementation date in sight. Police officials would not comment on the policy yesterday beyond saying the process is ongoing. The protest lasted just under an hour. Last month, the Alaska Black Caucus and other groups sent a letter threatening legal action over the lack of a body camera policy. Rich Kirtner is an attorney for the nonprofit.
I don't know what the holdup is. You know, it was privacy for a while. Now it's the union. Now it's arbitration. And it just seems like it's taking too long.
Kirtner says the Alaska Black Caucus is still exploring legal options to get the policy implemented. More than 200 homeless residents must leave Anchorage's Centennial Campground tomorrow. City officials are closing the area for the winter, and they now say they'll transport campers back to the Sullivan Arena, the site of a two-year shelter that was shuttered in late June. The city just confirmed the plan to reopen the shelter yesterday, following days of uncertainty for campers who didn't know where they'd go next. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more on what people are doing to prepare for the campground closure.
Lenny Concepcion has been staying at Centennial Campground for a couple months. The back seat of his SUV is packed with his belongings. He says he has a full storage unit, too.
It's kind of like a little nerve-wracking knowing, like, where am I going to move my stuff, you know? It's like, first, I already don't have a place to put my stuff, and now I have to move it. It's like, It's a lot, you know.
Concepcion says he and his girlfriend have been staying at the campground since early July, shortly after Mayor Dave Bronson closed the Sullivan Arena and began waiving fees and directing homeless people to Centennial. Concepcion heard from a fellow camper that Centennial will close tomorrow. He says he'll go to the Sullivan and hopes he can get help finding a job, but he's not thrilled about having to move.
I'm really not looking forward to having to go to the Sullivan Arena. But, you know, if that's something that'll get me into a better situation after this, then I guess, you know, it's something that could be, you know, in the plans, I guess.
Bronson's homelessness coordinator, Alexis Johnson, says she's been coordinating with the health department and Henning Inc., the contractor for the shelter, to get it ready for incoming campers.
We got everyone together and just started boots on the ground, getting things ready, got cots mobilized, and so we're still doing that right now. M&O is securing parts of the building, and we're full steam ahead is to get this fully operational by tomorrow morning.
Not every camper plans on going to the Sullivan, though. At a site near a sledding area by the main Centennial Gate, Wolf Shadowwind is starting his morning by making some coffee and watching his dogs. He's not shy when describing how hard it's been in the camp.
You know, I don't care if it's summer or winter. It's out here on the streets. It's not fun. You know, people might, oh yeah, it's stereotype. No, this. It's stupid out here. You know, you got people out here not by their choice, and they get stereotyped every time they ask for that help. You know, with me, I've been asking for it for years.
As much as Shadowwind doesn't like camping, he says he doesn't want to stay in the shelter either. He can't bring his dogs, for one. Also, he says he doesn't think that any providers will be able to help him get a job and housing. When the camp closes, he says he'll be headed to Big Lake with the promise of work and shelter for him and for, as he described them, his four-legged boys.
A friend of mine talked to this one lady that owns like a hotel or something. And I'm going to be a caregiver there. I can bring my boys. So, yeah.
As campers decide whether or not they'll go to the Sullivan, the assembly and the mayor's office still are not on the same page about how many people will be staying at the shelter. The assembly's emergency shelter plan passed on Monday includes using the Sullivan to shelter up to 150 people. Additional existing providers like Beans Cafe and Covenant House would expand operations, and the city would use the former Golden Lion Hotel as supportive housing. But the city argues that it can't use the hotel right now because of building issues and fire code problems. Instead, Johnson, the homelessness coordinator, is requesting the Sullivan capacity be increased to 300 people. The assembly is countering with a proposal to increase the shelter's capacity to 200. They would also lease 50 rooms at the Alex Hotel for non-congregate sheltering while the city works out a plan to use the Golden Lion. Assembly Vice Chair Chris Constant says he's fine waiting a week to fix issues involving fire codes at the Golden Lion, but he worries that this last-minute planning from the mayor's team will leave some campers behind.
There is no universe in when it's acceptable to pull the carpet out from under people with 24 or 48 hours notice and then give them no options. That's just not right. And it's in fact the exact same methodology that they used to demobilize the Sullivan Arena the first time. None of us knew. There wasn't an effective communicated plan.
Whether it's 200 or 300, Constant says the assembly may have to schedule a special meeting to increase the surge capacity at the Sullivan. Johnson says until then, she's working with a 150-person capacity. Officials from the city health department are due to arrive at Centennial on Saturday between 6:30 a.m. and 7. Johnson anticipates the first campers will be transported to Sullivan at around 9 a.m. In Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
A special investigation has concluded that Governor Mike Dunleavy did not orchestrate the firing of Angela Rodell, the former Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation executive director and CEO. The Alaska Beacon reports that Special Investigator Howard Trickey told the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee that, quote, the governor's office had no impact or influence upon the decision. The investigation found that Rodell's firing was at least partially based on a deficient evaluation process, but could be justified by trustees' lack of confidence in her leadership. The report concluded that trustees lost confidence in Rodell for a variety of reasons, including a belief that Rodell had made public comments at odds with the governor's administration. 5 of 6 Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation board members voted for Rodell's removal in December. Since then, 2 of the members who voted for removal have left the board, as has the member who did not. A spokesperson for the corporation said it's reviewing the legislative report and will respond after its review. At the time of her removal, Rodell claimed it was an act of political retribution by the Dunleavy administration, which had proposed a plan to increase spending from the Alaska Permanent Fund. Rodell did not respond to a request for comment. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, in Anchorage, the school bus driver shortage continues.
There continue to be a lot of job choices out there, including driving jobs. So I don't think we've seen the influx that we had originally thought.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
The nonprofit Providence Hospital System, which includes Alaska's largest hospital, aggressively pursued payment from needy patients who should have been eligible for free care. That is according to a New York Times investigation, which found that Providence, using guidance from a consulting firm called McKinsey & Company, trained its staff to pressure patients to pay their bills regardless of their income, rather than notifying them up front that they might be able to receive financial assistance. And if they didn't pay, the bills went to debt collectors. New York Times reporter Jessica Silver Greenberg wrote the story with her colleague Katie Thomas. Silver Greenberg says Providence avoids more than $1 billion a year in taxes with its nonprofit status, and in exchange, it's supposed to provide some level of what's called charity care. But Silver Greenberg says for many patients, that's not what happened.
Providence is supposed to post in all of its hospitals in Alaska, and this is a federal requirement. This is under the Affordable Care Act. They are supposed to inform patients about the availability of financial assistance. They're supposed to make it very clear and very easy to understand. In Alaska, their charity care policy says that anyone who makes under or at 200% of the federal poverty level should get free care. That's their own financial assistance policy. But our reporting shows that they were not informing patients that they qualified for charity care. In fact, a lot of the training materials developed for them had the opposite effect. Those training materials obscured the availability of financial assistance.
Yeah, and in your story, you talk about how there was this change at Providence towards this model where they're sort of obscuring the fact that there is this option for the healthcare to be written off, for the bill to be written off. But what was that change? And I guess how high up in the management structure did that decision-making go?
Right. So it went very high. So the change that you're describing happened in 2019 under the direction of the chief financial officer, where they stopped writing off the debts of Medicaid patients. And instead, they sent those Medicaid patients to debt collectors. And this is very important because Providence, in its response to our story, they have been sending letters from their CFO and others at the very top of the organization that say the policy toward Medicaid patients was a mistake. And that it was a glitch in the system, and that they fixed it and stopped sending Medicaid patients to collections in December of 2021. The thing that they are not saying, the piece of information that's being left out of that, is that an executive in 2019, so in December of 2019, sent a warning, like raised a red flag to other Providence executives, warning them that the changes to how Medicaid patients were being treated were producing a lot of harm. So this executive said, and I think this is powerful, "I just want it made clear to our leadership that patients that would normally have been eligible for charity care are going to bad debt." And by that, she means they're being sent to debt collectors. So that warning came in December of 2019. Providence didn't fix the problem until December of 2021. So we're looking at 2 years where Medicaid patients were being sent to debt collectors.
And in your reporting, didn't you also find some, I guess, incentive or some intentionality on behalf of Providence in trying to generate more revenue, right?
Yes. So the program that they turned to McKinsey to create was called RevUp. And it, like its name suggests, right, was, according to our reporting, all about collecting more from patients, even those patients who should have qualified under Providence's own policies, or more importantly, under state law for charity care. So yeah, the RevUp program is kind of the centerpiece of this article because, you know, in 2018, executives at Providence were pretty frustrated with the amount of free care that they were providing to patients. And so they set out to bring in more money from patients, and RevUp was their solution.
So there's this financial toll on patients who should have received charitable care, but then there's the emotional toll as well. And there was this really, I think, fair to say, tragic story from Alaska included in that article about a woman that had a really difficult and painful experience with pregnancy. Can you tell me about that?
Yes. So in 2019, Vanessa Weller, who was working as a manager at a Wendy's restaurant in Anchorage, went to Providence, Alaska Medical Center, and she was 24 weeks pregnant at the time, and she was experiencing abdominal pains. Tragically, she was in labor, and she gave birth to a baby boy who barely weighed a pound, and she qualified for entirely free care. And the baby that she had given birth to died after 5 days in the hospital. And when she was discharged and went home and she's grieving the loss of her son, these phone calls started from Providence. And she says she just remembers just this cold panic, because Providence employees told her that she owed, her bill was $125,000. So at the time, that was about four times what she made in a year. And no one offered her financial assistance. No one told her that she was eligible for charity care. No one told her she never should have received a bill. Instead, they, according to her, pushed her to pay half the amount. And then on other calls, she was offered a payment plan, she said. And, you know, she said something that really struck me in our interview is that she said it was like they were following some script, she said, like robots. And to me, what was so gutting in some ways about that is that, you know, Providence employees had been given a script to collect money from patients. They'd been giving lots of different scripts to approach patients with. And speaking about, I mean, Vanessa's experience is in some ways very illustrative of how that change to the way Providence treated Medicaid patients had a real impact, because we were able to obtain an email, it's in Washington's litigation with Providence, where an executive questioned why Vanessa Weller had this balance to begin with, right? Given her low income and the fact that she was Medicaid eligible. And someone else, a peer, you know, on the executive level, replied that previously, before the 2019 change, that bill would have been forgiven.
That was New York Times reporter Jessica Silver Greenberg. You can read her full story with Katie Thomas at nytimes.com. In a written statement, Providence denied that it failed to communicate to patients that they might be eligible for charity care and said it has changed its practices around using debt collectors.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
More than 40 remote communities in western Alaska saw impacts from a dramatic storm that battered the state's west coast in mid-September. Among them is Newtok, a village that's garnered years of national media attention as severe erosion and melting permafrost cause a wide range of serious public health problems. As Emily Schwing reports for Alaska Public Media, the storm has made conditions there worse and only heightened the race to relocate.
At the edge of a pond in Newtok, a small group of kids have abandoned their shoes to wade in the cold water and look for fish and beetles in the mud.
It's the tiny ones.
But beyond the pond, things are not as pleasant. Nick Tom, the manager of Newtalk's Native Corporation store, leads me across a stretch of waterlogged tundra and down a crooked boardwalk.
So the flood was all over this whole area.
He shows me the community's two giant fuel tanks, one for diesel, one for gasoline. The remnants of Typhoon Murbach left both partially submerged in floodwaters. A small fuel barrel leaked. There's the distinct smell of gasoline in the air, and there's debris and garbage scattered everywhere.
Everything is so outdated, and there's so much fuel. You know, it's just unsafe.
Melting permafrost and severe erosion have plagued this community for decades. The most recent storm brought waves so fierce the water claimed roughly half of the 80 or so remaining feet of land that stands between the back end of the school and the edge of the Ninglick River.
Everything is sinking. This whole region is a wetland.
20 years ago, Newtalk residents decided to move to a spot on higher ground. It's on Nelson Island, 9 miles south across the river. To date, only about 70 people, a third of Newtalk's population, have relocated to Machtervik. And the effort is slow going. It's complicated by local politics, funding gaps, and geography. Nick Tom says the need has never been more urgent.
Yeah, it's essential, yeah, because it's about safety, it's about our future. And the island is the only safe place for our next generation to survive.
My son is 2 years old, and my daughter's one.
Not too far from the damaged fuel tanks, Jeanette Stewart hangs bright red and purple bed sheets on a clothesline outside her house.
And you just did your laundry.
Yeah.
It smells so clean.
Thanks.
Stewart's house is small, about the size of a shipping container. The plywood walls are gray with age. The house sits above the ground on pilings, but floodwater from the storm still rose high enough to leak inside.
Living in this house, it's moldy, and I want them to live in a bigger house where they could run around and do stuff.
She dreams of a better, safer home at the new village site in Machtervik. To get there, Newtalk residents have to take a half-hour boat ride across the river, where the new community is slowly growing. Machtervik sits high on a tundra-covered treeless hillside. There's a huge gravel boat landing, and two rows of colorful houses line the brand-new road. Bernice John's house is red.
I love my house. It's way better than the old one I had back home.
As her grandson, Tom, runs wild around a spacious living room, John talks about last month's storm.
You know, it was sure very windy. It was the strongest winds we had. Shook my house here and there a little bit. Crashed my plants.
Unlike Newtalk, homes in Machtervik stayed dry. There was no structural damage. No boats or snow machines were destroyed. There's no storm debris. New housing is under construction in Machtervik, but there's still not enough for close to 200 people who are living in Newtalk. Nick Tom says they're running out of time.
More and more people move across there within the next 5-year period, probably.
Do you think you have 5 years?
Not really. If we keep having this weather, we have more erosion.
The fall storm season is only beginning in Western Alaska, which is why it's so urgent to get all of Newtalk's residents to higher ground. In Newtalk, I'm Emily Schwing.
Students in the Anchorage School District will have bus service on a rotating basis until further notice, the district told parents today. The district is currently 56 drivers short. District leaders had previously hoped to end the rotating bus schedule by the start of October, but Operations Director Rob Holland says not enough drivers are coming back from tourism jobs.
There continue to be a lot of job choices out there, including driving jobs. So I don't think we've seen the influx that we had originally thought based on history.
9 new drivers are expected to start in the coming weeks. 30 others are in training. The district is still offering a range of hiring incentives, including $2,500 bonuses for drivers who stay on through the first semester. The district is still in contract negotiations with Teamsters Local 959, the union that represents some school bus drivers. But Holland says he doesn't think those negotiations are playing a role in the hiring delay.
I'm sure that both sides are looking forward to a resolution where we can move forward with, anything extra. will be great in terms of the total package for our drivers. Both sides are focused on that. And that's all we can really say at this point.
At the beginning of the school year, the district divided school bus routes into three cohorts. Each cohort got 3 weeks of service and six without. Holland says 24 routes have been given full-time service based on high need. Cohort 3 will have service for the first time on Monday. District leaders are hiring a consultant to analyze the transportation system and suggest changes for next school year. Those might include changing school start and end times or further reducing the number of stops on each route. A federal grant will fund reclamation of watersheds damaged by historic mining operations in two areas of the interior. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The Bureau of Land Management has awarded $1 million in bipartisan infrastructure law funds to the Salcha Delta Soil and Water Conservation District to restore placer mining sites in the White Mountains and 40 Mile areas. Conservation District Programs Director Jeff Durham says the projects are just the latest his organization has partnered on with the BLM, targeting abandoned sites where streams were dredged prior to the implementation of reclamation regulations.
Leaving lots of tailings and piles in sort of a straight shot instead of a meandering kind of waterway.
Durham says that can lead to several problems.
There's concern about water quality and about impaired fish and wildlife habitat, impaired recreational opportunities. Oftentimes these watersheds don't operate correctly and can take out a road or ruin access.
Durham says restoration of the mining damaged streams starts with an assessment.
Go in and try and understand the system and then come up with a plan to put it back to as close to a natural stream as possible. So meandering, falls. The mining operations have left very little organic material, so there's not a lot of vegetation. So we bring that in from the surrounding area and we try to rebuild a natural looking stream course so that the watershed is protected from sediment through erosion, and that you can start to create these pockets of fish and wildlife habitat.
Durham says local miners are often contracted with to do the restoration work because they already have heavy equipment in the typically remote areas. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Wesley Early in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Newtok, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Tobin Shelby, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.